His fifth evening, Michael still had half the ham left, and the sight of it was enough to set him gagging. He had seen no game all day fit to kill, though late in the afternoon he had managed to bag a small rabbit. He made camp at dusk, skinned the rabbit, and built a fire. He had the rabbit about half done at the end of a stick when he was interrupted. Heart skipping, Michael propped the rabbit and stick against a log, grabbed his long rifle, and jumped to his feet.
Who's that out there?
Now, don't you get excited and pull that trigger, young fella. It's just me and old Quint. Ain't no harm in neither of us.
Michael's first thought had been of Indians, but he decided to judge for himself about the potential harm. He had heard enough stories to know that all the wild things in the woods were not animal. He held the rifle ready. He tried to make his voice sound deeper and older than it was.
You all come out where I can see you.
Two men stepped into the trail. Each carried a rifle and a small pack of possibles. Both were lanky and bearded and looked as if they'd not been out of the woods since Christmas. As they approached, they smelled that way too. The one who'd spoken had a patch where one eye was supposed to be. That did not lend to his beauty.
We smelt your fire.
How come y'all are out yonder instead on the trail?
We wasn't sure but what you might be Injuns. Me and Quint, we ain't got along too good with Injuns lately, you might say.
Patch Eye nodded toward Michael's rifle.
Oh, I sure wish you'd lower that thing. Rifles make Quint awful nervous, especially from the business end. They kind of bother me, too.
Michael lowered the muzzle a little, but not so much that he couldn't bring it up again in a hurry. Patch Eye shifted his attention to the tiny campfire.
I see you was fixing you some rabbit. Me and Quint, we ain't ate nothing since yesterday. We'd be much obliged if you'd seen your way clear to share some of that with us.
The fact that they asked gave Michael some relief. They could have rushed him and taken it if they wanted to. He lowered the rifle more.
The rabbit's kind of small, but I got a ham. Y'all might find that to your liking.
Patch Eye glanced at his partner and grinned.
Ham? Ooh, you hear that, Quint? Why, we've forgotten what hog tastes like. The Lord himself must have sent you down here for us to find.
The one called Quint whipped a long knife from his belt. Instinctively, Michael stepped back and raised the rifle again, but Quint attacked only the ham. Almost in a frenzy, he cut off a slice and jammed it into his mouth raw. It was smoked, and Michael knew some people ate it without cooking, but such a thing struck him as savage. He supposed these men must be on the edge of starvation. Patch Eye wrenched the ham from Quint and cut a piece for himself, eating it as Quint had with near desperation.
You ain't got a pot or a skillet?
Nah, I've been doing all my cooking on a stick.
That ain't quite civilized, but it'll do, I reckon.
Patch Eye cut another slice of the ham and impaled it on a stick, as Michael had done to the rabbit. Quint followed his example. The two men shared Michael's fire. Piece by piece, they reduced the ham to bone. Michael shrugged. He was sick of the ham anyway, but now the two visitors had left him no choice. He would have to join Papa tomorrow and take his chances. Surely, as far as he had already come, Mordecai would not send him home.
I wish you had some coffee, or better still, some whiskey. But I reckon you ain't got nothing like that.
All I had was that ham.
That and the rabbit. Watching the pair destroy the ham, he had wolfed down the rabbit in self-defense, lest they take part of it, too. He had seen Papa come home hungry many a time, but not that hungry. When nothing was left to eat, the two men relaxed. Across the campfire, Michael could feel Patch's one good eye studying him.
What are you doing out here all by yourself? You are by yourself, ain't you?
Papa's camped on down the trail a piece. I'll be catching up to him tomorrow.
You ain't too well fixed for traveling. Looks to me like you might have left home sort of sudden. Like maybe you had somebody after you.
Michael didn't want anyone thinking he was a fugitive. But he figured what he was doing here was his business.
Ain't nobody after me.
Me and Quinn, we know what it's like to not want to be found. We come out of Kentucky. There's some folks there who'd sure like to see us again. But we ain't at all anxious to see them, eh, Quint?
Yeah.
We've been 3 days throwing some creek engines off our trail. We couldn't tell at first what you might be one of them yourself.
How come there's engines after you?
A misunderstanding, you might say. We was doing some trading amongst them. Had us a prime bunch of skins to take back to the settlements. Then a little disagreement come up over a girl.
Yeah.
A pretty little thing she was. Well, for an Injun. When a man's been away from the settlements for a long time, you'd be surprised how good-looking them Injun girls can be. Well, this one they were saving back to marry off to some young chief or something, keeping her pure and unspoiled, you might say. Seemed like an awful waste, saving stuff like that for some greasy Injun. The night me and Quint left camp, we sort of borrowed that girl, you might say. We didn't do her no real harm. We turned her loose after a few days so she could go home. But she wasn't quite so pure and unspoiled no more. Was she, Quint? You'd think them redskins would be grateful we didn't kill her. We'd have been justified, the way she kept fighting us like a catamount. But they dogged our trail for 3 days. We lost our pack horses and the pelts and everything to them. Hard to understand how an Indian thinks.
Michael's father had fought Indians since his boyhood, and Michael had never questioned the rightness of it. But this story filled him with revulsion. He was impelled to speak his mind.
You wouldn't do a thing like that in the settlements, not to a white girl.
But she was just an Indian. The way them redskins come after us, you'd have thought she was a white girl.
I suppose they got the same feelings as white folks have when it comes to their women folk.
You ain't one of them Indian lovers, are you, boy?
Papa was in the Black Hawk War and some other fights, too.
Then you ought to know that in the end, it'll be them or us. The world'll be better off when the last of them red devils has gone back to hell where they come from.
Michael had learned a long time ago that it was useless to argue with somebody whose mind was nailed shut. To do so only brought aggravation and sometimes a fight, which settled nothing any better than the argument had.
Where are y'all figuring to go from here?
What do you want to know for?
Just asking.
Michael was wishing they hadn't found his camp, and he wondered how Papa would have met a situation like this.
I don't mean nothing.
Me and Quint, we just sort of take things as they come. Man goes to making too many plans, he gets all tied up to where he can't move when he wants to.
Michael spread his blanket, trying to put some distance between himself and his visitors, for their aroma did not improve with familiarity. Their manner kept him uneasy. Patch and Quint huddled together. The longer he considered, the more troubled he became. He tried once in the middle of the night to get up and slip out of camp without waking them, but Patch must have slept with that one good eye open. Michael was hardly upon his feet before Patch was standing in front of him, rifle in his hands.
Oh, it's you, is it, boy? I'd like to have shot you for an Injun. You better lay back down and be still. We'd all be a lot less nervous.
Michael stretched out again, more agitated than before. He laid his hand on his rifle and made up his mind not to sleep. Sometime in the early morning, his best intentions came to naught, and he nodded off. Michael woke as dawn was breaking. He raised up on his elbow and saw Quint throwing Michael's own saddle on the horse. Michael reached for his rifle, but it was gone. He jumped to his feet, flinging the blanket aside.
What are you doing with my horse?
Patch stood with a rifle in each hand. One of them was Michael's.
Sorry we woke you up, boy. We was hoping to just leave you a-sleeping.
You all let my horse alone.
Michael took a long stride toward Blaze. Quint gave him a silent look that spoke of murder. The ferocity of it caused Michael to pause and ponder his odds. They looked poor.
Now, boy, you just stand back so we won't have to hurt you. We need this horse more than you do. You said your papa's just a ways ahead. You can catch up to him afoot if you push yourself. We ain't got no pap to see after us.
You've got no right.
Michael's outrage overcame his caution. He made two more strides toward Quint.
You better hit him again.
Next time I bust this good rifle.
You don't have to use no rifle.
Quint picked up a heavy piece of tree limb broken off by some high wind. It came to Michael suddenly that Quint intended to kill him. He wanted to cry out, but no sound came. He tried to move aside, but could not. The impact was like an explosion in Michael's head. Lights wheeled and darted and danced.
We'll ride and tie. You ride the horse a ways, then tie him and go on. I'll trot along behind you and pick him up where you leave him.
All right. Hand me that boy a shot pouch and powder horn. The way I hit him, he never get up from where he's laying.
Damn fool, Button. Serves him good and proper.
Michael tried pushing himself up, but was unable to do more than raise his head a little. Through the painful haze, he saw a patch moving along afoot back toward the settlements. Ahead of him, on blaze, rode the man called Quint. Blaze jumped. Quint tumbled backward to the ground. Michael wondered in anger what cruelty the man had committed to make Blaze act that way.
Injured!
Through the red haze, he saw Patch wheel and run back toward him. Several men burst from the timber. They grabbed Patch and roughly wrestled him down, smashing his face against the ground. Michael blinked away the haze. His heart pounded. Indians. Fear shook him, raw, cold fear, for he was sure they would come to get him next. He tried desperately to push himself up. He was helpless. He collapsed, exhausted, eyes burning so badly he had to close them. He lay with the side of his head on a mat of leaves. He heard soft footsteps and opened his eyes. He saw two leather moccasins inches from his face. Forcing himself to turn onto his side, he looked straight up at what seemed the tallest man he'd ever seen. A leather-clad Indian holding a steel-headed tomahawk. Michael held his breath, expecting that blade to come crashing into his skull. Michael did not understand the words. He supposed they meant death. His stomach was like ice. Another Indian came up to stand beside him. Strong hands grasped Michael's arms and lifted him to his feet. His heart hammered. He tried to stand, for he had been taught that Indians respected a man who faced his fate bravely. His legs betrayed him. The two Indians caught him before he hit the ground and eased him back to his knees.
Oh, please, please. Please, y'all kill me.
Michael doubted that the Indians understood Patch's words. Even if they did, it was not likely to make any difference. They had come for revenge on Patch and Quint. It was Michael's bad luck that he had been found with them. His head threatened to burst. Blood trickled into one eye, setting it afire. To his surprise, one of the Indians rubbed some kind of pungent grease on the wound. It burned for a moment, but he sensed that its purpose was medicinal. He blinked in confusion, looking up at first one of the dark-skinned men, then the other. It seemed strange that they would treat his wounds if they intended to kill him. He knew little about identifying Indian tribal connections, but he thought this was probably Creek country. For one wild moment, he wondered if they somehow knew that his father had once fought against them. He decided that was far-fetched.
I don't know what y'all want with me. I never saw them two before last night.
The tallest Indian made a motion with his hand. His companions dragged the terrified Patch up in front of Michael, twisting his arms behind his back and forcing him down on his knees.
Coyote! Coyote!
Michael did not understand, but evidently Patch did.
They think we set out to do you harm, boy. In God's name, tell them it's all a mistake. Tell them we're old friends. Tell them me and Quint ain't the ones they've been after.
You tried to knock my brains out.
I'll make it up to you. I promise. I'll give you back everything we're taking off you.
They've got it all now.
Boy, have some charity. Help me, or I'll end up dead as old Quint yonder.
Michael could see Quint lying twisted where an arrow had taken him. His scalp hung fresh and bloody from an Indian's waist. Michael had seen scalps before, brought back by the veterans of Indian battles, but they'd always been cured and dried, so time had somehow blunted the specter of death. He had not seen the open, sightless eyes of the victim before. His stomach crawled, though he managed not to lose last night's supper. Mordecai had told him Indians despised a show of weakness.
Please, boy! You don't know what they're fixing to do to me!
No worse than you was fixing to do to me, I reckon.
Michael supposed he should try to help Patch. After all, he was white. But Michael saw not one thing he could do. He would be lucky to come out of this thing himself.
I ain't gonna lie for you.
Coyote in with the Kaya.
The Indians dragged Patch away.
No, boy, please! No!
Good. The boy does not lie for that man. He can take horse, I thought.
Michael stared in surprise as one of the other Indians fetched Blaze to him. The two who had helped him to his feet boosted him up into the saddle. They handed him his shot pouch and his powder horn. It took a minute for him to realize that they were actually setting him free. Relief washed over him, though he didn't really understand. The tall Indian pointed at the rifles.
One is yours?
Michael indicated the weapon that had belonged to Grandpa. The tall Indian handed it to him.
You must go now.
Michael hesitated. He pointed his chin at Patch.
What are you fixing to do to him?
That is a bad man. You do not want to see.
Papa had told Michael some things about the Creek War. Things on both sides which could turn a strong man's stomach to clabber. The warriors had torn Patch's clothes from him, leaving him naked. His skin was as white as the belly of a catfish. They had taken the patch, exposing the empty eye socket like something long dead. They tied him against a tree, legs spread apart.
Blaine, I'll kill him, Blaine.
The tall Indian gave Michael a sign to ride on, with a special firmness this time. Michael thought he had best comply before they took a different notion. He put Blaze into a healthy trot. Michael's emotions were a confused turmoil of anger, fear, and relief. Never before had he come so near death that he could feel its bony hand on his throat. The closest had been the time in the forest when he inadvertently placed himself between a sow bear and her two cubs. She had come at him with a roar that meant murder and struck him one hard blow that slammed him against a tree. But she had not followed up the attack. She had taken her young and disappeared, grumbling loudly. Michael had been in fights before, though always with boys more or less his own age, and usually about nothing of more moment than his recent scrap with the Blackwoods over the ownership of a downed doe. Never before had he confronted someone who made a serious effort to kill him. He had always been conscious that such things happened. They had happened to Papa, but Michael had been emotionally unprepared to have it happen to him. He stopped an hour or so later as he came upon a stream. He washed away the dried blood the best he could, though the Indian grease still clung. He knew by the feel of it that his face was swollen, and a knot of some size had risen on the back of his head. He did not tarry long at the water, fearing that when the Indians got done with Patch Eye, they might forget their generous natures and come after him, too. Fear constricted Michael's throat at the sound. For it might be more Indians, or trail vultures like Patch Eye and Quint. He looked desperately to both sides of the trace for cover heavy enough to hide him and Blaze.
Well, easy there, boy.
Eli Pleasant rode up on the horse, Jug, borrowed from Uncle Benjamin. He raised his hand in greeting.
Howdy, boy. Your pa decided I ought to come back and fetch you. He thought we'd left you trail behind us long enough.
You knew?
Over the last 2-3 days. Your pa thought you'd give up and go home, and if you didn't, it'd add considerable to your learning was you to make your own way a while longer.
Pleasant squinted critically.
Good Lord, young. You look like you've been in a scrap with a bear. What does the other feller look like?
By now, I expect he looks dead.
Mordecai tried to be stern. When Michael and Eli rode up to the picket line where the horses were tied, Mordecai strode briskly out from the campfire to meet them. He looked 7 feet tall, his brow furrowed.
Now, Michael, you heard me declare more than once that you wasn't going with us.
Then he saw Michael's swollen face, bruised a dark blue. His resolve melted like April snow. His jaw dropped in dismay.
God almighty, son, what went and got a hold of you?
Michael was so choked with emotion at the sight of his father that he could hardly speak. While the rest of the party gathered around, he clung to Mordecai as if he'd not seen him in a year. Eli recounted what Michael had told him about the two land pirates and the Indians. Mordecai looked as if he'd been kicked in the stomach. He placed heavy hands on Michael's shoulders and stared remorsefully into his son's eyes.
My God, boy. I had no idea, or I wouldn't have let you hang back there all by yourself. I'd have carried your blood on my soul plumb to the grave.
Mordecai put his strong arms around Michael and gave him a hug.
I don't want to go back home, Papa.
What you done was foolish, son, but I done worse, leaving you back there. I reckon you've earned the right to stay. Come on now, put some warm victuals in your belly. You'll feel better.
I don't know if I can hold it down. I feel like I'm going to throw up.
That's no disgrace. We've all done the same one time or another. It's almighty mean the first time you have to watch a man die hard. I was younger than you. You looked like you stood it better than I did.
That patch-eyed feller, he kept a-crying for me to do something to help him, but I didn't do a thing, Papa. I just stood there.
What would you have done? Get yourself killed for the likes of him? He deserved whatever they done to him.
But they was Injuns, and he was white. You fought Injuns yourself, Papa, lots of times.
Well, I had to, but I wasn't always proud of it. My side was chosen for me the day I was born. I was given no choice. Maybe it'll be different for you.
Mordecai put a hand on Michael's shoulder and led his son to the campfire.
Now, you get something in your belly, it'll put the strength back into you.
Just a minute, Mordecai. You mean you're letting this boy stay?
Mordecai stiffened against the challenge.
I believe he's shown he can handle whatever comes, Cyrus. He's Lewis, and my son.
Maybe so, but he's not a full-grown man yet. I don't see it's fair to give him a man's share of the horses we catch. That'd take away from the rest of us.
My boy came near getting killed. No, you can think about his horses we ain't even caught yet.
Cyrus looked around for support, but found none in the faces of the other men. Clearly they sided with Mordecai and Michael. Eli clenched his fists and moved toward Cyrus as if he had violent intentions. Cyrus put his hands up defensively and backed off.
I'm just thinking about my family.
Mordecai gave Cyrus a withering glare.
Michael come without permission, so any share he gets will be out of mine, not out of yours or anybody else's. That satisfy you?
Yeah, satisfied.
Michael glanced at the picket line. There stood a black horse that had a snip nose and a star on its forehead.
That your horse, Cyrus?
At Michael's age, his upbringing would have dictated that he address the man as Mr. Blackwood, but he would gag on that. Cyrus seemed surprised by the question.
That's him. Why?
A while after you left, some fellas named Thomas come looking for a black horse. Suspicion that somebody stole it.
Well, there's lots of black horses.
They said theirs had a snip nose and a star on its forehead. Like yours. Said it had a stocking on the right foreleg. Like yours.
Cyrus looked around quickly, trying to gauge the reaction of the other men.
Now that horse was a stray. Come up eating my feed. I didn't know who he belonged to.
I don't reckon you asked around too much.
Cyrus turned and stomped away.
He's a thief and a liar, Papa. You ought to send him home.
I ought to send you both home, but I reckon we come too far. We'll make do the best we can with what we've got.
In many ways, the long trip to Texas was like a festive hunting and fishing party. The traveling was paced to be easy on the horses, which made it easy also on the men. Mordecai usually went into camp early to allow time for the men to fish if they stopped beside a likely stream, or to fan out and search for meat. A few days went by without one or more deer being brought to ground, and more than once a good fat bear that yielded grease enough to fry up more venison than the party could eat. Game birds added to the variety. Michael couldn't help visualizing what the trip might have been like had Uncle Benjamin been in charge. They would already be in Texas hunting horses. Mordecai Lewis might interrupt business for pleasure, but he did not often interrupt pleasure for business. Michael couldn't remember that he'd ever been this close to his father for so long at a time. He cherished the opportunity to get to know the man who'd been something of a mystery to him, as much myth as reality. Mordecai had always seemed to be gone somewhere, or just getting back, or fixing to leave. Michael knew him as much by the stories people told about him as from his own personal relationship, and the stories had made Mordecai seem 8 feet tall. Close up, Michael began to see that this was a man of flesh and blood, not a legend. He was a man in middle age, hard used by the outdoor life he had lived by his own choice. His hair was graying, his face furrowing, his eyes in a hard squint much of the time because he no longer could see the world around him in the sharp focus of his youth. He was a long way from being frail, but he was far short of 8 feet tall. Evenings, on a creek bank with their fishing lines in the water, Michael and Mordecai might sit together for an hour without either saying a word. Or if Mordecai was in a talking mood, he might recount old stories about adventures on his way to a war or on his way home from one. Of war itself, he talked little, and Michael had little success in drawing him out. Mordecai's face would cloud as some painful memory came to him, and he would shift to more pleasant subjects.
War is a mean, hard thing. It makes men do the best that's in them, and the worst. Since the British gave up and went home the second time, maybe we're finally through with it for good in this country.
Where Michael enjoyed his father's company most was on the hunt. For there, Mordecai could give full rein to his restless, questing spirit. He could find a track where Michael couldn't see the least sign of one. Michael would have to admit that his younger brother Andrew had been a better pupil in that regard. But Michael's eye was keen when it came to spotting game, keener now than Mordecai's. Michael was the one who first saw the buck browsing in a tangle of underbrush some 300 yards away. The wind was wrong. Michael suspected it carried a little of their scent, for the buck seemed increasingly suspicious, nervously jerking its head around, looking intently in their direction, taking another bite, then looking again.
Yeah, we'll never get close enough for a clean shot at him.
Mordecai leveled his long-barreled rifle across a limb to steady it. He blinked, trying to clear the haze, then lowered the rifle.
Yeah, it'd be a waste of good lead.
I can hit him, Papa.
From here, it can't be done.
Let me try anyway.
Michael braced his rifle barrel upon the same limb his father had used. He allowed for windage and the long distance. Through the black smoke, Michael saw the buck leap high, then collapse, kicking.
I'll be damned.
Wasn't so far.
Michael felt like bragging a little, but it was more seemly to act modest. Mordecai clapped him on the shoulder hard enough that it hurt, yet at the same time, it felt good.
Well, there ain't much more I can teach you, son. The student has got better than the teacher. I just wish Eli could have seen that.
Michael was only glad that his father had seen it. From now on, perhaps he would no longer harbor reservations about Michael's audacity in coming along. The trail Mordecai followed was plain enough, but not much traveled. The Tennesseans sometimes rode for days without meeting a stranger. Now and again they came upon a clearing and a small farm recently broken to the plow. The settlers, who did not often have an opportunity to enjoy company, would almost invariably insist that the party stay and share whatever provender the land had yielded. Mordecai Lewis would examine their crops admiringly, running his hands through their soil and declaring it rich. More than once, some of the party suggested they had gone far enough, that this would be a good place to put down stakes. But always, Mordecai found something lacking about the location. Better land always lay somewhere ahead, across the Mississippi, then across the Red or the Sabine. He would trade fresh venison or bear meat or hides for corn or coffee or whatever the settlers could spare that would make the night encampments more pleasurable. Then he would move on. Beyond the Mississippi, they came more often than not upon people who spoke a strange tongue that fell pleasantly, if confusingly, on the ear. Old Eli identified it as French. He knew a fair smattering of it, though Michael sensed that his usage was awkward. Children covered their mouths with their hands to hide their laughter, but their eyes betrayed them. Eli laughed with them and put them at ease. This land, long the property first of France, then of Spain, and then again of France, had been sold to the United States in 1803, all the way west to where it abutted Spanish territory. That border had long been the subject of dispute between France and Spain, and now was a matter of delicate diplomacy between Spain and the United States. Spain had done relatively little to develop its northernmost lands, but she had remained jealous of their possession. She now watched fretfully an increasing population of aggressive Americans in the vast territory so recently acquired by purchase from France against the Spanish will. Americans were notorious for always wanting more, for wanting to advance beyond what rightfully belonged to them. The Indians had learned about that. Michael had always regarded his father as being immune to ordinary human frailties, and it came as a saddening revelation to discover that Mordecai suffered from rheumatism. He had never owned up to it at home, but on the trail it was not to be denied. On evenings, when riding had set the rheumatism to hurting more than usual, Mordecai would forego the opportunity to fish or hunt, preferring to rest in camp. At such times, Michael liked to ride out with Eli Pleasant, or sit with him on a riverbank while they waited patiently for fish to strike the bait. Eli had a storehouse of remembered experiences and could recite them for hours without repeating a story. However, Michael pressed him again and again to relate his adventures hunting horses in Texas. Texas by now had taken on the aura of a golden land in Michael's mind, a golden promised land for the adventuresome, the breakers of new trails. Eli obliged him with tales of a bold Irishman named Philip Nolan, who had first crossed into Spanish territory before the turn of the century to trade in wild or half-broken horses, driving them east to sell to American settlers. Pleasant's voice went harsh as he talked of Nolan's last expedition. Eli had broken a leg trying to tame a wild young stallion and was unable to go along, a misfortune which probably saved his life. The Spanish had become suspicious, with justification, it seemed, that Nolan's plans included the acquisition of much more than horses. He had cast covetous eyes upon the rich soils of eastern Texas and had speculated aloud that God and mankind would be better served if the land were attached to the United States. The Spanish military took the precaution of shooting and carrying his men away to captivity deep in Mexico.
Yep, them Spaniards, they can take a liking to you and give you the moon. Or they can take a disliking to you and cut your throat before you can find the door. A man don't ever want to quit watching behind him when he's in their country.
They may not like us being there then.
Well, the trick is to not let them find out.
The first few nights after joining his father's party, Michael didn't sleep well. He would awaken with a start in the darkness, seeing the man named Quint lying in his final death throes, an arrow in his back, and hearing Patch Eye scream as his own slow death was just beginning. Michael would sit up in a cold sweat and look around in confusion until he remembered where he was. Mordecai was always there, his manner gentle and reassuring.
It'll pass. You'll see worse and you'll be better fixed to stand up to it for what you've already gone through.
Michael shuddered. What kind of a future offered worse than he had already seen? Eli had been patient and easy-moving, but as the party skirted Louisiana's deep-shaded swamps and crossed its rich black farming lands, nearing old Natchitoches, he became dissatisfied with the slow pace of travel, with Mordecai's early making of camp in the afternoons. He finally came to blows with Cyrus Blackwood, who'd been a constant irritant to the party, as Michael had known all along that he would. Blackwood was relentlessly discontented, complaining about the food, about the campsites, about having to stand guard at night when everybody knew there was nothing out there to stand guard against. The only person who had seen an Indian the whole trip was Michael, and Cyrus declared his suspicion that Michael had imagined it all. One night, Cyrus was supposed to relieve Eli on guard duty at the picket line, and did not. Eli shook him in his blankets.
Help me, you son bitch!
Oh, that's it!
By the time Eli finished administering retribution, Cyrus was not fit for guard duty. One eye was swollen shut, and the other had only a thin slit left open, just enough that Cyrus could see to get out of Eli's way.
You'll be wishing you sent him home, Mordecai.
We'll be needing all the men we got.
Well, you got no men there, and he'll keep one good man out of useful service just to watch the son of a bitch.
We come too far to send him back.
Well, you tell him to stay out of my way. I got all the patience in the world with a man who tries but can't. I ain't got 3 minutes to waste on one who don't even try.
The rest of the way to Natchitoches, Cyrus Blackwood made it a point to trail along in the rear, well out of Eli's reach. That did not prevent his grumbling about one thing or another, but it kept the others from having to listen. Mordecai remarked upon sighting Natchitoches that it was not a large town as towns went. It looked large to Michael, but he'd not seen many towns in his life. The place seemed like an oasis after such a long trip across lands so sparsely settled. Most of it lay on the west side of a river which Eli said was called the Red. Across its gently flowing waters, Michael saw tree-lined streets and many houses of a curious style. Single-story for the most part, their roofs higher pitched than the cabins he had known. He saw boats on the river, small steamers up from New Orleans, flatboats carrying off their cargoes of farm produce to a waiting world. There was a bustle and a busyness about the place which made his pulse quicken. There was far too much to see all at one time. Too many glittering curiosities competed for his attention. Eli Pleasant rode up to a house where a man stood waiting at the front door. Recognition came, and the man rushed off the porch with his arms outstretched as Eli swung down from his saddle, betraying none of the weariness to which his years would have given him just claim. The two men conversed in the language which Michael had come to recognize easily as French. Then the man approached Mordecai, right hand extended in greeting.
Boys, this is my good friend Baptiste Villeray.
Eli patiently introduced him to everybody except Cyrus Blackwood. The man looked at Cyrus with a question in his eyes, but Eli ignored it. He put his arm around Baptiste's shoulder and turned him away. Michael could not miss the resentment that leaped into Cyrus's face. Cyrus got down from his horse, led him out to a shed, and relieved himself against the log wall without concern over whether Baptiste had womenfolk who'd be offended. The gesture was typical of his attitude toward most of the people they had encountered along the way, especially the French. Cyrus had declared it his solemn belief that this country ought to be reserved for good Americans, and people who spoke some devilish foreign language ought to be shipped back where they came from, or perhaps just shot. Eli pointed out to Michael, but felt no obligation to explain to Cyrus, that this country had belonged to the United States for only a dozen or so years. Anybody born here earlier was likely to be French or Spanish or a mixing of the two, or, of course, a slave. Though his acquaintance with the voluble Frenchman had been casual and short compared to Eli's. Baptiste offered Mordecai's company the hospitality of his house. The structure was too small for all or even most of the men to sleep indoors.
Well, that's real nice, but me and the boys have gotten used to sleeping under the stars. Ain't no point in spoiling them now. But if it's all the same to you, we would appreciate it if you'd let us roll out our blankets beneath the porch, just in case it rains.
But of course, Monsieur Mordecai. But of course!
Baptiste did have womenfolk, Michael soon learned. He had a Spanish wife, a woman of dark complexion, small but possessed of enough energy for three. There were four daughters, the oldest a lithe and lively girl named Marie, who reminded Michael of nothing so much as a dauphin. Darker in complexion than her father, but lighter than her mother, she was a couple of years younger than Michael, about Andrew's age. She was glorified by flashing black eyes unlike any he had ever seen. He listened to the music of her voice, though he did not understand the words. And he glanced often at her as she bustled about the kitchen, helping her mother prepare a meal for the Tennesseans. More than once, he found her gaze upon him. His cheeks would warm, and he would try to put his mind to work on what his father and Eli and Baptiste were saying. Baptiste spoke rapidly, his hands in constant motion. From his manner and Eli's, Michael knew he told of dark and troubling matters. The name Rodriguez kept coming into the conversation. More than once, Eli had to slow him down and get him to repeat. At length, Eli turned to Mordecai.
I'd hope somebody might have killed that damned Lieutenant Rodriguez by now, but he's still going strong. Baptiste's been telling me about a friend of his by the name of Lucero. From over on the Spanish side of the Sabine. Seems he's a rebel, got himself on the losing side of a fight against the Spanish government. He escaped over here just barely ahead of Rodriguez in a firing squad. He snuck back to get some stock he left behind, and Rodriguez found out. He tortured a cousin of Lucero's and then killed him for revenge. Baptiste says we better stay out of Texas for a while. Rodriguez is watching the river.
We didn't come this far to turn back.
Well, that's what I told him. I said Texas is a big enough country that we ought to be able to keep them soldiers from finding us. Just the same, Baptiste's advice is, don't go.
Mordecai cast an uneasy glance toward the rest of the men resting out on the porch.
I'd assume we didn't say nothing right now where they can hear it. Time enough to worry them when we find out for sure how bad the situation is.
Eli nodded darkly.
They'll be wanting to cut loose and celebrate a little, and put a little whiskey under their belts, maybe find them a woman for company. No use us taking that pleasure away from him.
Eli asked Baptiste something in French, and Baptiste nodded, amplifying his spoken reply with a pointing of both his chin and his finger.
Fact is, there's a widder lady of my acquaintance that I had sort of set my hopes on seeing. Baptiste says she's still a widder.
Now, I don't reckon being a married man you'd care for that kind of diversion, Mordecai?
Mordecai shook his head and glanced at Michael.
I ain't been the best husband in the world, but I'm better than that. A little something wet to warm my stomach and lighten my soul. That'll be all I need.
Well, then I'll point the boys in the direction they'll be wanting to go, and the rest of it they can work out for themselves.
Eli stood up and started for the door.
Better leave Cyrus Blackwood here. He's a married man like me.
There ain't one thing about him that's like you.
Michael followed Eli to the door.
You'd best stay here with me, Michael. There's things out yonder that you'll learn about by and by. Tonight's too soon.
Michael figured he already knew a lot more than his father suspected, thanks partly to living with sisters and in no small part to long discussions with his cousin Frank. But he stopped at the door and watched the men gather eagerly around Eli. Even old man Wilson seemed as exuberant as the young bachelor Macklin brothers. Michael thought the grizzled veteran should be content to try and wear the rockers off of the chair on the porch, but the old man had never once lagged behind on the trip or failed to carry his share of any load. The book-learned Judkins had suffered some at first, deprived of the whiskey to which his system had become overly accustomed, and Michael suspected that when the celebration in Natchitoches was done, he'd have a lot more whiskey to sweat out of his pores. As the group started down the tree-shaded street toward the main part of town, Cyrus Blackwood was out in front, turning and motioning for the others to walk faster.
Eli's right, Papa. Cyrus Blackwood ain't no ways the same as you.
Dusk came down upon the old French town. Michael sat on the porch, listening to his father and Baptiste Villeray. The conversation ranged from crops and the sad state of the farm economy to Villeray's strong confidence that sooner or later, Texas must become part of the United States. The Spaniards would never do much with it, he contended. The government was in constant strife with the native citizens of Mexico, resentful over being exploited for the enrichment of the pure-blood Gachupines, who held the political and military power. The king lived far away, across the great waters, and perhaps didn't know or even care what was happening to his subjects in the New World, so long as a goodly portion of their labors delivered gold into his treasury.
One day there'll be a revolt, and he'll lose all of Mexico. And perhaps Mexico will sell Texas to the United States as France sold Louisiana.
Mordecai drew on a home-rolled cigar. An old dream was in his eyes, the dream of faraway places that had kept him moving and searching since he was Michael's age.
If they don't want to sell it.
Villeray glanced sharply at him, fathomed his meaning, and nodded agreement.
Their army would be smaller, for it is a poor country.
Michael wearied of sitting on the edge of the porch and listening to talk of politics. He got up, then went wandering around the house. Villeray had some sheds and pens out back. Michael decided to investigate. He found old man Wilson's dun horse fighting the others back with a rack of hay. That animal was a little like the Spanish king they were talking about, a selfish tyrant. He had challenged every horse in the bunch and established his dominance over most of them. He seemed to have a particular dislike for the black horse Cyrus rode and would bite it at any opportunity.
Bonjour. Comment ça va?
Michael turned from the wooden fence and saw Marie Villeray.
Don't you speak any English?
Je ne comprends pas.
Marie pointed into the pen.
Quel est cheval est le vôtre?
When Michael stared in confusion, Marie pointed to him, then to the horses. He decided she was trying to ask which was his. He pointed to Blaze, by all odds the oldest animal in the pen.
C'est un beau cheval.
Her response seemed complimentary, best he could tell. He decided she didn't know much more about horses than she knew about English. She moved close beside him, looking into the pen at the animals. He felt suddenly a little flustered, for he had never been at ease around girls, except for his own sisters, and sometimes not them either. He felt like moving away, but he did not. He found that despite his uneasiness, there was something pleasurable about the nearness of her. He fancied she smelled a little like sweet soap. Old man Wilson's horse made a lunge at the big sorrel Papa had borrowed from Uncle Benjamin. The sorrel wheeled and kicked the aggressor in the belly hard enough that the Wilson horse broke wind.
Les chevaux pétons sont bizarres, comme les signes d'essence.
Michael took that to be approval. The sorrel moved up to the hay rack and began to feed, while the Wilson horse backed off and looked frustrated, as if plotting its next treachery.
Can you ride a horse?
Marie shrugged, not understanding. The Wilson horse made a run at the sorrel, which turned and defended itself with sharp teeth. Both horses smashed against the fence. The girl fell back against Michael, and instinctively he caught her. The moment she remained in his arms, embarrassed and uncertain, but no more so than he was.
Je suis désolé. Je dois aller maintenant.
Her cheeks flushed, she hastily retreated to the house. She stopped at the door and turned to look back at him before she disappeared inside. He stared at the door long after she was gone, his face unaccountably warm. He fancied he could still smell her sweet fragrance. He felt both elated and frustrated. More than either, he felt confused. Michael spent the next day walking around, watching the busy hoof and wheel traffic, the boats, large and small, loading and unloading their varied cargoes at the wharves. He learned that Natchitoches was the head of navigation, because a short distance to the north, the Red was blocked by a huge natural raft of driftwood, built up over the ages, that prevented boat passage. He listened to a dazzling mixture of languages, for this town had been founded by the French 100 or so years ago as they sought to spread their influence in the New World. The Spanish, in reaction, had founded the town of Natchitoches, a day's ride to the west, attempting to counter any French expansion in that direction. For generations, the two governments had sparred and quarreled from afar while their soldiers and their settlers fraternized peacefully, smuggled and traded, and even intermarried. Baptiste Villaret's family was evidence enough of that. From little things he picked up, mostly from Eli, he deduced that the merchant Villaret had long done clandestine business west of the Sabine, smuggling goods to Spanish settlers in Texas, trading for or buying contraband from them in defiance of the law. It seemed to Michael that the Frenchman had reason to wish for a change in the government which ruled Texas. Sometimes when Michael was around the house, he'd get a strong feeling that he was being watched. Often as not, when he turned, he saw the girl Marie, her dark eyes fixed on him. She would quickly busy herself in some task or move out of his sight. The boldest she ever got was to go to the horse pen in the evening when he was putting out hay and watch him through the fence. She seemed to be trying to work up courage to say something. He knew it was futile. He wouldn't understand her anyway. But she surprised him. She pointed to him, then to herself.
You like me?
I guess so. But I don't hardly know you.
Marie stared blankly, not understanding. She tried again, pointing first to herself, then to him.
I like you.
Before he could say anything in reply, she turned and ran to the house. He almost forgot to finish forking hay to the horses. He thought he might ask Eli how hard it was to learn French. Mordecai intended to remain in Natchitoches several days, resting the horses as well as the men. But the stay was cut short when the Macklin brothers got into a fight over some local beauties and left a couple of flatboatmen whittled up a bit. It seemed expedient to cut the visit short and be gone. Mordecai had conversed at length with a grim-faced Guadalupe Lucero through Baptiste, whose ability to switch back and forth from English to Spanish and French left Michael in awe. Lucero was a dark-faced, muscular man with black eyes that simmered and crackled in bitterness and hatred as he related his experiences. He would speak for a time in broken English, then become dissatisfied with the slowness of it and revert to Spanish.
I will go back one day, and when I do, I will not be hunting for horses.
Lucero drew a rough map for Mordecai, showing how he might enter Texas well south of Natchitoches and be most likely to avoid contact with the small military troop which operated out of there. Lucero made a quick slicing motion across his throat.
That Rodriguez is the devil. Lucero will see one day if the devil can be killed.
Lucero was on hand to see the Tennesseans off in the cool of dawn, along with Baptiste and his family. Michael lifted a hand in quiet farewell to the girl whose dark eyes had said things he readily understood, though the words she spoke to him in French remained a mystery. As the men rode away, Michael looked back. He saw Marie watching him, her face sad, and he saw Lucero make the sign of the cross. Cyrus Blackwood complained from the start. Mordecai had been obliged to drag him out of a warm bed in which he was not alone.
I don't see why we had to be in such a damn rush just on account of them Macklins. I tell you, Mordecai, it ain't often a man finds him somebody who wants it as bad as that little Creole woman. There weren't no quit to her.
Mordecai glanced at Michael, then grabbed a handful of Cyrus's shirt. For a moment, Michael thought his father would drive a fist into those filthy whiskers and see if he could find the chin.
This boy don't need to be hearing that kind of trashy talk. You shut the hell up, Cyrus, or get the hell back to Tennessee.
Cowed, Cyrus pulled away and ducked his head.
I didn't mean no harm. I got boys of my own. Good boys.
You got a wife, too, if you ain't forgot.
Cyrus let his gaze drift over the men as if looking for someone to take his part. He found none. He never had. He slowed his horse and let the men ride past him. They all made a point of not giving him a glance. Michael looked back hopefully, thinking Cyrus might indeed turn eastward toward Tennessee. He was disappointed. Cyrus took a place at the rear of the ragged column. Guided by Eli's memory of the country, augmented by the rough map Guadalupe Lucero had provided, Mordecai led his group across the span between the Red and the Sabine Rivers. Good farming land by the look of it, though much was not yet taken up or broken out. Mordecai gave it but brief attention, for his blue eyes held to the west. At the bank of the Sabine, he halted and stared a long time at the heavy trees which lined the opposite side. Mordecai crooked his finger and beckoned Michael up beside him.
Your eyes are better than mine, son. You see anything over yonder?
Excitement coursed through Michael like the electricity he sometimes felt in a spring storm.
I see Texas. That is Texas, ain't it?
Well, it's Texas, but that wasn't my meaning. You see anything that could be people? Like soldiers, maybe?
Michael squinted. The only movement he saw was the trees, their branches swaying gently in the wind that roved along the river. In a break between the trees, he could see the land stretching far beyond, far westward, a sea of tall green grass that waved as he had always imagined the ocean would wave.
No, sir, I don't see a thing. We're going on a cross, aren't we?
Not we, just me and Eli. We'll go have ourselves a look-see. Everybody else will rest on this side of the river till we make sure there's no trouble waiting for us yonder.
Michael's rump prickled with impatience to put this river behind him and set his feet upon the land he had anticipated so long. Texas. Yonder it stood, so near he thought he could skim a rock across the water's surface and hit it.
Let me go with you, Papa. You can use my eyes.
Mordecai shook his head.
Your eyes are fine, but old Blades' legs ain't as good. If it come to a horse race with Spanish soldiers, you might not finish.
Mordecai responded to Michael's disappointment by placing a big hand on Michael's arm.
Like as not, we'll find everything clear and you'll be going over soon enough.
Eli grinned.
I promise you, boy, we won't try to catch no wild horses till you get there.
Cyrus Blackwood waited until Mordecai and Eli had pushed their horses into the river and out of hearing.
In my day, a button didn't open his mouth till he was told to, and he didn't say nothing except what he was asked.
He sensed that Cyrus was trying to pick an argument with him. He sensed also that Cyrus was afraid of Mordecai, so picking on Mordecai's son was an indirect form of retaliation. Michael wanted to oblige the reprobate, but his father would say that only a hog gets down into the mud to wrestle another hog. He turned awkwardly away without giving an answer.
I was talking to you, boy!
Old man Wilson rode up beside Cyrus. His dun horse wickedly took advantage of the opportunity and sank its teeth into the hide of Cyrus's black. Cyrus rolled on the ground and scrambled desperately to get out of his panicked horse's way. He glared angrily at old man Wilson.
You done that on purpose! That horse of yours needs a whip taken to him!
Wilson never spoke except when it was necessary.
You ever try it, and you leak that whip, handle and all.
Wilson turned toward Michael.
That old pony of yours needs a rest, son. Why don't you take the saddle off of him, let him graze a spell?
As always, Cyrus swallowed his pride and turned away. He caught his black horse and led it apart from the others. He sat on the ground in the horse's shadow and sulked.
Don't you pay him no mind, son. Him and his whole family ain't worth a bucket of cold spit. The only opinion you need to be concerned about is your papa's and your own.
My own?
Sure. Always be at peace with yourself, and you can go to sleep at night justified.
Mordecai and Eli returned after a couple of hours, satisfied that soldiers were nowhere around.
All right, boys, let's go to Texas.
The water was colder than Michael expected. It took his breath. He found himself shivering as he followed his father's lead and slipped out of the saddle to make it easier for his horse to swim. He held on to Blaze's mane, for he was not much of a swimmer himself. The trees on the Texas bank seemed to bob up and down in rhythm with the horse's movement. As he found shallow ground, Michael caught Blaze's reins and led the horse up onto dry land. Blaze shook himself like a dog. Michael wondered if his old leather saddle could stand the punishment. The stirrups swung wildly, and Cyrus Blackwood had to step back to avoid being struck.
Damn stupid button.
Cyrus gave Michael a hard glance. Michael refused to let Cyrus's sourness spoil his exhilaration.
Texas!
He had finally reached it. He stood trembling from the cold as the wind searched through the wet cotton shirt stuck to his body. Or perhaps it was not altogether from the cold. He looked up the bank, past the trees, at the expanse of rolling prairie stretching to the horizon. He thought the air here smelled differently from that on the Louisiana side, though he knew this was wild imagination.
Oh, beautiful!
Eli Pleasant smiled.
Looks pretty much like the other side, but I reckon it's like the Bible says. The forbidden fruit always tastes the sweetest.
Is it really all that forbidden?
You'll know it is if we run into an officer by the name of Rodriguez. Come on, Michael, help me wipe out these tracks.
Each of them broke a small limb from a tree. As the others moved up over the riverbank and into the shelter of the timber, Michael and Eli dragged the branches across the horse's tracks and boot prints on the wet soil. They were only partially successful in making the ground look as smooth as before.
Yeah, time it's dried and the wind has worked on it a little while. It'll be all right.
Michael pointed into the timber.
What about up there?
Yeah, any patrol that comes along will work the riverbank. If they don't find nothing here, they ain't out to look further. Come on now, boy, we'll get left.